And so he made wine and he made beer, and we helped bottle beer, and every now and then those things would blow up too if they weren't just exactly the way they should be. But I think that, and Mother made her own bread. She made wonderful rolls, and I can remember my brother and I thought during the Depression particularly that she ought to sell rolls and we would sell them, and my mother said that'd be just fine if you fellas will help make them, and that didn't work so well. But she made all our own bread, and she pickled and preserved. She made our own cottage cheese. She made a German kind of cheese called Handkäse that was simply wonderful, that out of old cottage cheese, and you make it in hard kind of cakes, and it had caraway seed in it, and it'd be so hard you had to scrape it. Mm. Afterwards, we had our own cream, and it was that we got from the country. We always bought our milk and cream from the country because it was lots less expensive than having it delivered to the door. And I don't know, we slipped and slid over roads in the wintertime that now, you know, with no kinds of snow tires or anything. There was lots of snow in northern Ohio in those days, big drifts and lots of times sleet storms. But my mother, I guess I may have said this earlier, had that German saying, and it goes, with a lot, one can do a lot. With a lot less, one can also do a lot. And so that if she saw that, like when we bought cream, if she sent my father or me or my brother to that farmer with a quart jar or a quart milk thing, that the lady would always give us more than a pint. If you just took a pint jar, you'd just get a pint. It was just, she just was very frugal about everything. She threw nothing away. And as I said, she even, when we had a whole hog, she helped make sausage, head cheese, all that, tried out the lard, made her own soap from time to time, although she wasn't great for that. She didn't like to all that much, but made all the sheets and the pillowcases and everything. So I guess having been brought up that way, and with her, never, if she was worried about money, she didn't ever say it. And we always said, everybody knows what we have, and you know what we can afford, and we just don't do it if we can't afford it. But as I probably said earlier, lots of times I had clothes that really from our spot in life I shouldn't have had, because she went without, I know. Yeah. And I always will remember the first coat she got that had fur trimming on it. And it was a beautiful coat with moleskin trimming on it. And it was an occasion for all-round celebrations. And then my father had a half-brother who was a hunter, and he shot muskrats. And I inherited a muskrat coat from his daughter, who was older than I, when his daughter went to become a nun. And so I had a muskrat coat when I was in high school. It was really a monstrosity, but it was wonderful because it was fur. But I had coats that had fur collars on them before my mother had a coat that was trimmed with fur. Yeah. So I guess I can say that the whole family was in the same boat. Nobody in our family had a lot of money. And things just went along pretty much as usual.
Let me ask you, since we covered in some detail the high school years last time, let me ask you now about your beginning college at Miami University in Oxford. First of all, why did you go there?
I didn't speak about that earlier.
No.
Well, that's kind of interesting because I had a history teacher in high school who was a wonderful lady. And she was a Delta Gamma, and she always wanted me to go someplace where there were Delta Gammas. I didn't know a sorority from anything, not at all. Nobody in my family had ever graduated from high school, let alone go to college. And so, and there wasn't really very much money, and my mother and father didn't want me to have to work. I had gotten practically straight A's all through high school, and I was expected to earn good grades in college, and I knew I wanted to be a teacher. And so it really didn't make that much difference where I went to school. I didn't look around, but I looked for scholarships. And in those days, there wasn't a lot of student financial aid around. You had to get a named scholarship almost from some college or university, and you applied. So I had a friend whose cousin had gone to Oberlin, so I applied there, and I got a small scholarship. And Oberlin wasn't very far away. And I didn't know whether Oberlin was a great school or a not-so-great school. It had a good reputation in northern Ohio, but there were colleges every place in Ohio. I think Ohio at that time had 88 counties, and there must have been at least a college in every county. And my English teacher had graduated. She came to teach our English class in high school as her first teaching assignment, so she wasn't that much older than we. She'd gone to Ohio Wesleyan. And she urged me to try for a scholarship at Ohio Wesleyan, and I did, and I got a better scholarship there than I had at Oberlin. So I dropped Oberlin, and I was going to be at Ohio Wesleyan. And then my history teacher said, you ought to try the state schools. And I didn't want to go to Bowling Green State College. That was very close to where we lived, and that's where we went to take all of our scholarship tests. And we... In Ohio, in those days, every high school student took a test every year. It was a statewide test given to every student, and you took the tests in the subjects that you were taking in high school. And so I had stood in the top 10 in Ohio of students, and I don't remember where. I wasn't number one, but I was in that top 10, so I was eligible to apply for scholarships at state schools. And I just hadn't done it. I knew I didn't want to go to Ohio State. That was too big, and I didn't like Columbus, Ohio, anyhow. So I tried for Miami University, and I got, and I don't remember the name of the scholarship, but it was for 4 years, and it was for tuition and board and room. And so that was equivalent of my working my way through school. And so it was kind of hard to get to Miami by train, which was the only way I had to go, and that was way down in southern Ohio. But I could go by train, and you had to change trains at a little crossing where one railroad crossed another, a little place called Deschler, and stay there in kind of the switchman's hut, because it didn't have a regular they didn't have a regular waiting room there. My father would go with me and then put me on the next leg, which went down to Hamilton, Ohio. And then from Hamilton, Ohio, there was a little, like, interurban sort of thing that would go to Oxford, which was a very small town. And Miami University had, at that time, I think a total enrollment of only about 2,100 students. That was big to me compared with my high school, but nevertheless, it was a small school. And Western College for Women was right next door, and Miami even then was considering itself the kind of the Harvard of the Middle West, and it had been commenced I think as an academy also by some people who wanted something better, and then was taken over by the state. And at that time Ohio had 5 state universities or colleges. There was Miami, Ohio University, Bowling Green, I think that was still a college, it might have been Bowling Green State University, Kent, and Ohio State. And those were all of the state-supported schools. Some of my very good friends from high school were going to Ohio State. It wasn't too hard to get from Miami to Ohio State. The one boy was going to Yale. That put him out of commission, except that I did go to visit Yale a couple of times while I was at Miami. And then some of them went to Athens, to Ohio University, but and then some of them to Western Reserve and the schools in Cleveland, but I was the only one that went to Miami. So I was kind of alone when I went down there, and but as a scholarship student, and I lived in a freshman dormitory, and the dormitories that we lived in were really leftover kind of temporary housing from something that had been moved onto the campus. They were there were some wonderful dormitories because Miami was an old school. It celebrated its 125th anniversary when I was a senior, 1931. So it was founded in what, 1806? And Ohio became a state in what, 1809? I don't know, but it was an old school, and some of the old buildings, Harrison Hall, for example, was named after William Henry Harrison, was a wonderful old red brick building, but these dorms were pretty primitive. So when I got there, I was kind of flummoxed, and also to have to live with another person in that little tiny room. We had to take all our own bedding, all our own lamps, everything. The college furnished practically nothing. And it was my first experience with living with that many girls that close and being that far away from home and friends. And in our family, you didn't make long distance calls in those days unless it was a disaster. So for that long distance, you would just struck terror in your heart. and I wasn't terribly good at writing back and forth. But in those days, they had house mothers. There were lots of rules and regulations. You knew what time you had to be in. But meals in the dormitory were served family style, but with white tablecloths, napkins. You were taught manners. The silverware was all there, and certain students cleared the tables and other students served. So you took your turn doing that, but the ones who were being served didn't hop up and help themselves to anything, and there was passing going on all the time. And I think I weighed 123 pounds when I went off to college, and my gosh, my freshman year, I gained weight like you wouldn't believe, because it was so wonderful to be able to go to Tuffy's, which was the college hangout, where they had the most wonderful rolls. They would split them, and then they would butter them, and then they would put powdered sugar on top, and then they would put them under the broiler, and they were simply out of this world good. And on top of that, somebody was always sending out at night for those big bread donuts. That was my first experience with that kind of donuts. And we drank hot chocolate, and I just ate a lot and drank a lot and didn't do that much exercise outside of gym classes, and kept catching what for from my gym teachers because of a weight gain. And my mother and father, when I finally went home, I guess this weight didn't become that apparent until like Easter vacation. And my mother said, I can just tell you one thing, kiddo, you're either going to, because I had gone from 123 to 137, and that was a lot. And she said, you're not going to get a whole new wardrobe, so it's going to become an economic problem. You're either going to lose weight or you're going to have to, I don't know what, but we can't.
Where is that? Huh?
You just won't have much to wear. And so at any rate, my first summer at home, I went right back down to where I should have been, and I stayed about that same weight until in the Navy, when I was stationed down in Texas on a base, and we did a lot of eating and drinking because there wasn't anything else to do. That was a miserable place to be, and they always served two eggs and all of the stuff they were serving for men. But be that as it may, I was rushed by a lot of sororities. I didn't know anything about sororities or anything about how you did it or anything. But my big sister was a wonderful gal who just happened to be a Delta Gamma, and she was a big woman on campus, and I formed an immediate attachment to her. And so I joined Delta Gamma, partly because of my history teacher who was pushing me in that direction, but mostly because of Jane Benham from Sydney, Ohio. And I wasn't a very good sorority member. In fact, I got to be a very bad sorority member. We didn't have sorority houses. at Miami, even though Miami was the home of the Miami Triad, Beta, Sigma Chi, and Phi Delta Theta, were founded there, and they all had wonderful houses. And my best good friend who went to Ohio State became a Sigma Chi. And my brother, when he came down to Miami, became a Beta. And I dated fellas from different fraternities, but I was pretty much of a grind. I must say that I didn't spend a lot of time out on dates, and I had all these fellows that were going other places that were coming to visit me, or I was going to visit them, and I was writing to them constantly. These were my high school chums that I stayed in close touch with, especially my freshman year, because it was like a, you know, being home. It was more security. And I wasn't scared to death by college, but I was just apprehensive that I wasn't going to do as well as I should. And college classes were so different from high school classes. And but I got very well acquainted inside my dormitory, and the net result of the whole thing was, because there weren't sorority houses and I got acquainted with all of these different girls, my first roommate was not chosen for a sorority, and it was such a wretching, bad experience for her. She didn't come back her sophomore year because she was determined to be a sorority member, and I could have been without one, and it wouldn't have made a bit of difference to me, and I had all these bids, and she didn't have any. And she was a Jewish girl. I had had friends that were Jewish and I didn't think anything about it one way or another, but I didn't realize how awfully discriminating sororities were against Jewish people. We did have a Jewish girl in the Delta Gamma. She was a beautiful girl from New Jersey, and her last name was Schwartz. And I don't know, nobody ever made anything of it, but actually we shouldn't have had her by the way the sorority ran. I just didn't have much sympathy for the whole thing, and I got terribly interested in the YWCA and black gals, and felt terribly bad that they had to sit in the peanut heaven of the, if we go to Cincinnati to a movie or something. And just, it wasn't the circle that sorority wanted you to move in. And so then my roommate my sophomore year and I were the resident monitors, or whatever they were called. They were, that isn't what they were called, but they were the student resident people. And that was a part of getting our room free. And that was she was a wonderful girl, and as it turned out, she was an illegitimate child. And in those days, that was my first brush with that too. And I might have known students in Bellevue, or there might have been kids whose mothers were called widows that really weren't widows, and they were single parents, but nobody ever made anything of it. But when Ruth then, she didn't join a sorority her freshman year because she wanted to be a tri-delt, and they didn't ask her to be. And she and I just kind of formed a nice friendship. We lived together. We stayed together as resident hall advisors all during the rest of our time. And when she was a senior, she wanted to join a sorority, and I put her name in for Delta Gamma. She also was eligible for Phi Beta Kappa in her senior year. I had been made a Phi Beta Kappa in my junior year, and I put her name in for Delta Gamma. And by this time, Delta Gamma had gotten to be mostly run by girls from Cleveland and Chicago and Newark, New Jersey. And I knew that I just didn't fit their mold very well. I was not buddy-buddy with any of them, and I was living in a dormitory with all these other kids and all these other sororities and everything. And and at any rate, when I proposed her name in my sorority, and one of those Chicago gals stood up and said, "I don't like Ruth Larimore." That was the occasion for my formal break with my sorority. I made my speech. about fraternity and, you know, and sisterhood and all of this sort of stuff, and that this was my roommate. This was one of the most worthy girls, big woman on campus. She'd been involved in lots of stuff. And I said, whether you like her or don't like her, that you could stand up in this sorority and say that to me, her very dear, good friend and roommate, just indicates to me that I think we don't have a heck of a lot in common, and I don't need you, and I'm sure you don't need me. And I walked out. And so that was kind of the end of it. I never turned my pin in. I never gave it up. But as you can see, I have joined this view of sororities. On the other hand, when I was on the board of higher education, and fraternities and sororities came under fire as they did in those mid-60s, late 60s and early 70s, I was one of the strong champions of them, not of any particular one or not of any particular things they stood for or anything, but that kids who were saying, don't spindle me, don't number me, don't make me a throwaway, I'm a person and I count. And the colleges grew so fast, and people didn't pay that much attention to students. I swear some of them would have been happier if there had been no students on the campus. They kind of bothered some of the professors and some of them that wanted to do research more and didn't really want to put up with a lot of guff from students. And they were getting it from all sides. I felt that a fraternity or a sorority was some place where a student could be an individual. And in those great big dormitories, life wasn't very pleasant, and why not? But be that as it may, I knew that the reason that they courted me so hard was because of my GPA, and it did good things for the GPA, mm-hmm. for the sorority, because I got one B in college all through the whole 4 years, so that my GPA was pretty high. Mm-hmm. And when I'd been taken into Phi Beta Kappa my junior year, it had been because a French teacher that I had, a French lady, that this was my first brush with modern foreign language that you had to speak. And I would fall into the hands of somebody that was as perfectionist as she was. And I don't remember her name now, but she announced right at the beginning of the class that she never gave any A's to any freshman. And that there wasn't anybody in the United States who could start French and do well enough to qualify for an A. And at the end of the first semester, she called me into her office, and she said, I can't do anything except give you an A, but I want you to know that this is not really what it ought to be, but I can't find any reason not to give you an A. And then she started talking to me, because all my other grades were A's, to about qualifying for Phi Beta Kappa in my junior year and going on and doing graduate work and all of that sort of thing. And don't take too many education courses, because no education courses count toward Phi Beta Kappa. So you could take psychology, you could take a lot of those other courses, you could take all of the liberal arts. And in those days, they didn't have it just by a distribution thing. They told you what you had to take. So history of Western civilization and English literature and all of the rest of that, that was all, strictly speaking, academic, liberal arts subjects would count. And and so that I should leave the education courses till my senior year. And she said, maybe by that time you won't even want to take them. But I knew that I had to do something to be able to earn a living. And in those days, women, particularly in college, either were there because it was a commonly understood thing that you'd meet your husband in college someplace, and it didn't make that much difference then what you took, because you weren't going to work anyway, or you became a teacher, or you were going to be a nurse. And you didn't study nursing in college, you studied nursing in hospitals in those days. And ironically, it turns out those were the best nurses training, that was the best way to get nurses training there was. And even after we've gone just overboard with the credentialing and the degrees and whatnot, they still go back to say the best nurses training was in hospitals and the way that was done. or you became a secretary and you didn't have to go to college to do that, or you took business administration, but there wasn't going to be a job. Or you could be you could study mathematics and science if you were that way inclined, and I wasn't. So I whatever her name was, just insisted that and she helped me map out my whole college career so I'd have the right courses and have the right grades and so forth. And I got 1B in a Latin course, and that was because of a fluky thing that happened, and I won't go into it. But and then I didn't do so well in PE, particularly not baseball. I remember the day they were taking the grades. I had passed the written part of the exam with an A, but I struck out twice, and I got put out on first once, and then when I was out in the field, I missed the balls. I got an F in the practical business for baseball, but I was my grade was a C. But they didn't count those into your GPA. So, but to just finish the Phi Beta Kappa, to just show you how these things kind of change. I saw the other day 101 students had been invited to join Phi Beta Kappa at the University of Oregon. And I can't remember how many students there were in my graduating class, something on the order of 500 or thereabouts. And there were 15 of us all together, I think, who were Phi Beta Kappas, and a number of us were in our junior year, and that was considered, you know, better if you earn Phi Beta Kappa in your junior year, because then you can qualify for scholarships afterwards. And the job market and everything was just about as poor when we were getting out in 1935 as it would have been. So going on to graduate school was what a lot of the fellows were going to do, and they were encouraging some girls to do it too, so the better chance you have to get a scholarship from some company if you were a fellow, or from some school if you were, I mean, just to do academics if you were a girl. But by the time Ruth was eligible in her senior year to be a Phi Beta Kappa, the rules at Miami got changed, and all of a sudden you had to have this kind of activities, you had to have this kind of leadership, you had to have this kind of grades, you had to have this kind of recommendations. And I never could find out from anybody why Ruth wasn't admitted to Phi Beta Kappa. And I tried my level best. I went to every professor that was the head of it. And finally, the head of it, who was a chemistry professor, and I knew him pretty well, said, "Miss Hill, if you want to graduate from this college as well-liked as you are now, you will just stop this crusade." And I should never have done it. You know, you would do things over again, but at the time, I just let him browbeat me, and I shouldn't have, because she was eligible. And he always said that maybe she would be awarded it after she graduated. I said, come now, how many alumni ever get Phi Beta Kappa in retrospect, and what does it mean if you get it in retrospect anyhow, ever after the fact? And she never did.
What was your assumption at the time about what was involved there?
I just didn't know, but I was too afraid that it was just what had bothered the sorority business. And she and I never spoke of it, never. She wasn't that kind of a girl. She was just a very fine, fine person, and so was her mother. And I know nothing about the circumstances at all, except one of the Tri-Delts was the one that told me. And but we never spoke of it. And I visited her in her house, and she visited me. And we lost track, unfortunately, after I went off to Wellesley, and she became a school teacher. And then she married, and we wrote. But I have no idea what's happened to her now. On the other hand, some of those girls that went through the dormitories that were freshmen, that we got to know as we were living in the freshman dorms, and of course you could get to be pretty much a favorite by the time you got to be a senior. You're living with undergraduate or lower division kids. Mm-hmm. Some of those I've kept in.